The Rebellion Within. In May 2008, a fax arrived at the London office of the Arabic newspaper Ashark al-Awsat from a shadowy figure in the radical Islamist movement who went by many names. Born Sayyid Imam al-Sharif, he was a former leader of the Egyptian terrorist group al-Jihad, and known to those in the underground mainly as Dr. Fadl. Members of al-Jihad became part of the original core of al-Qaeda. Among them was Ayman al-Zawahiri, Osama bin Laden's chief lieutenant. Fadl was one of the first members of al-Qaeda's top council. 20 years before, he had written two of the most important books in modern Islamist discourse. Al-Qaeda used them to indoctrinate recruits and justify killing. Now, Fadl was announcing a new book, rejecting Al-Qaeda's violence. "We are prohibited from committing aggression, even if the enemies of Islam do that," Fadl wrote in his fax, which was sent from Torah prison in Egypt. Fadl's fax confirmed rumors that imprisoned leaders of al-Jihad were part of a trend of former terrorists renouncing violence. His defection posed a terrible threat to the radical Islamists because he directly challenged their authority. "There is a form of obedience that is greater than the obedience accorded to any leader, namely, obedience to God and his messenger," Fadl wrote, claiming that hundreds of Egyptian jihadists from various factions had endorsed his position. 2 months after Fadl's fax appeared, Zawahiri issued a handsomely produced video on behalf of al-Qaeda. "Do they now have fax machines in Egyptian jail cells?" he chided. "I wonder if they're connected to the same line as the electric shock machines." This sarcastic dismissal was perhaps intended to dampen anxiety about Fadl's manifesto, which was to be published serially in newspapers in Egypt and Kuwait among al-Qaeda insiders. Fadl's previous work, after all, had laid the intellectual foundation for al-Qaeda's murderous acts. In Cairo, I met with Gamal Sultan, an Islamist writer and a publisher there. He said of Fadl, "No one can challenge the legitimacy of this person. His writings could have far-reaching effects not only in Egypt, but on leaders outside it." Usama Ayyub, a former member of Egypt's Islamist community, who is now the director of the Islamic Center in Münster, Germany, told me, "A lot of people base their work on Fadl's writings, so he's very important. When Dr. Fadl speaks, everyone should listen." The roots of this ideological war within al-Qaeda go back 40 years, to 1968, when two precocious teenagers met at Cairo University's medical school. Zawahiri, a student there, was then 17, but he was already involved in clandestine Islamist activity. Although he was not a natural leader, he had an eye for other ambitious, frustrated youths who believed that destiny was whispering in their ear. So it was not surprising that he was drawn to a tall, solitary classmate named Sayyid Imam al-Sharif. Admired for his brilliance and his tenacity, Imam was expected to become either a great surgeon or a leading cleric. The name al-Sharif denotes the family's descent from the Prophet Muhammad. His father, a headmaster in Beni Suef, a town 75 miles south of Cairo, was religiously conservative, and his son followed suit. He fasted twice a week, and each morning, after dawn prayers, studied the Quran, which he had memorized by the time he finished sixth grade. When he was 15, the Egyptian government enrolled him in a boarding school for exceptional students in Cairo. 3 years later, he entered medical school and began preparing for a career as a plastic surgeon, specializing in burn injuries. Both Zawahiri and Imam were pious and high-minded, prideful and rigid in their views. They tended to look at matters of the spirit in the same way they regarded the laws of nature, as a series of immutable rules handed down by God. This mindset was typical of the engineers and technocrats who disproportionately made up the extremist branch of Salafism, a school of thought intent on returning Islam to the idealized early days of the religion. Imam learned that Zawahiri belonged to a subterranean world. I knew from another student that Ayman was part of an Islamic group. He later told a reporter for Al-Hayat, a pan-Arabic newspaper. The organization came to be called Al-Jihad. Its discussions centered on the idea that real Islam no longer existed, because Egypt's rulers had turned away from Sharia and were steering believers towards secular modernity. The young members of Al-Jihad decided that they had to act. In doing so, these men were placing their lives, as well as their families, in terrible jeopardy. Egypt's military government, then led by Gamal Abdel Nasser, had a vast network of informers and secret police. The prisons were brimming with Islamist detainees, locked away in dungeons where torture was routine. Despite this repressive atmosphere, an increasing number of disillusioned Egyptians were turning to the mosque for political answers. In 1977, Zawahiri asked Imam to join his group, presenting himself as a mere delegate of the organization. Imam understood that his agreement was conditional upon meeting the Islamic scholars who Zawahiri insisted were heading the group. Clerical authority was essential to validate the drastic deeds these men were contemplating. The meeting never happened. Ayman was a charlatan who used secrecy as a pretext, Imam said. I discovered that Ayman himself was the emir of this group and that it didn't have any sheikhs. In 1981, soldiers affiliated with Al-Jihad assassinated the president of Egypt, Anwar Sadat, who had signed a peace treaty with Israel 2 years earlier. Sadat's successor, Hosni Mubarak, rounded up thousands of Islamists, including Zawahiri, who was charged with smuggling weapons. During the next 3 years, Zawahiri and Imam, who had once been so profoundly alike, began to diverge. Prison hardened Zawahiri. Torture sharpened his appetite for revenge. He was humiliated and disgraced by the fact that he had given up the names of his confederates. He abandoned the ideological purity of his youth. Imam, by contrast, had not been forced to face the limits of his belief. Leaving his real identity behind, Imam slipped out of Egypt and made his way to Peshawar, Pakistan, where the Afghan resistance against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan was based. He took the name Dr. Fadl. It was common for those who joined the jihad to take a nom de guerre. He adopted the persona of the revolutionary intellectual in the tradition of Leon Trotsky and Che Guevara. Instead of engaging in combat, Fadl worked as a surgeon for the injured fighters and became a spiritual guide to the jihad. When Zawahiri finished serving his sentence in 1984, he also fled Egypt. He was soon reunited in Peshawar with Fadl, who had become the director of a Red Crescent hospital there. Their relationship had turned edgy and competitive, and besides, Fadl held a low opinion of Zawahiri's abilities as a surgeon. He asked me to stand with him and teach him how to perform operations, Fadl told Al-Hayat. I taught him until he could perform them on his own. Were it not for that, he would have been exposed as he had contracted for a job for which he was unqualified. In the mid-80s, Fadl became al-Jihad's emir. Fadl claimed in al-Hayat that this was untrue, saying that his role was merely one of offering Sharia guidance. Zawahiri, whose reputation had been stained by his prison confessions, was left to handle tactical operations, deferring to Fadl's superior learning in Islamic jurisprudence. Kamal Helbawi, a former spokesman for the Muslim Brotherhood, was also in Peshawar and remembers Fadl as a haughty, dominating presence who frequently lambasted Muslims who didn't believe in the same doctrines. Fadl is not a social man. He's very isolated, according to Hani al-Sibai, an Islamist attorney who knew both men. Ayman was the one in front, but the real leader was Dr. Fadl. Fadl resented the attention that Zawahiri received. In the interview with al-Hayat, Fadl said that Zawahiri was enamored of the media and a show-off, and yet he let Zawahiri take the public role and give voice to ideas and doctrines that came from his own mind, not Zawahiri's. This dynamic eventually became the source of an acrimonious dispute between the two men. In Peshawar, Fadl devoted himself to formalizing the rules of holy war. The jihadis needed a text that would school them in the proper way to fight battles whose real objective was not victory over the Soviets, but martyrdom and eternal salvation. The essential guide for preparation appeared in 1988 as the Afghan jihad was winding down. It quickly became the central text in the jihadis' training. The guide begins with the premise that jihad is the natural state of Islam. Muslims must always be in conflict with non-believers, Fadl asserts, resorting to peace only in moments of abject weakness, because jihad is, above all, a religious exercise. There are divine rewards to be gained. He who gives money for jihad will be compensated in heaven, but not as much as the person who acts. The greatest prize goes to the martyr. Every able-bodied believer is obligated to engage in jihad, since most Muslim countries are ruled by infidels who must be forcibly removed in order to bring about an Islamic state. The way to bring an end to the ruler's unbelief is armed rebellion, the guide states. Some Arab governments regarded the book as so dangerous that anyone caught with a copy was subject to arrest. On August 11, 1988, Dr. Fadl attended a meeting in Peshawar with several senior leaders of al-Jihad, along with Abdullah Azam, a Palestinian who oversaw the recruitment of Arabs to the cause. They were joined by a protege of Azam's, a young Saudi named Osama bin Laden. The Soviets had already announced their intention to withdraw from Afghanistan, and the prospect of victory awakened many old dreams among these men. They were not the same dreams, however. The leaders of al-Jihad, especially Zawahiri, wanted to use their well-trained warriors to overthrow the Egyptian government. Azam longed to turn the attention of the Arab Mujahideen to Palestine. Neither had the money or the resources to pursue such goals. Bin Laden, on the other hand, was rich, and he had his own vision, to create an all-Arab foreign legion that would pursue the retreating Soviets into Central Asia, and also fight against the Marxist government that was then in control of South Yemen. According to Montasser al-Zayat, an Islamist lawyer in Cairo who is Zawahiri's biographer, it was Dr. Fadl who advocated supporting bin Laden with members of al-Jihad. Combining the Saudis' money with the Egyptians' expertise, the men who met that day formed a new group called al-Qaeda. Fadl was part of its inner circle. For years after the launching of al-Qaeda, They would do nothing without consulting me, he boasted to Al-Hayat. In 1992, 3 years after the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan, Zawahiri and most members of Al-Jihad relocated to Sudan, where bin Laden had set up operations. Zawahiri urged Fadl and his family to join them there. Fadl, who was completing what he considered his masterwork, The Compendium of the Pursuit of Divine Knowledge, agreed to go. Zawahiri picked us up from the Khartoum airport and took us to our flat, Fadl's son Ismail al-Sharif told me. Zawahiri said, You don't need to work. We will pay your salary. We just want you to finish your book. From Sudan, members of Al-Jihad watched enviously as a much larger organization, the Islamic Group, waged open warfare on the Egyptian state. Both groups wished for the overthrow of the secular government and the institution of a theocracy, but they differed in their methods. Al-Jihad was organized as a network of clandestine cells centered in Cairo. Zawahiri's plan was to take over the country by means of a military coup. The Islamic Group was a broad above-ground movement that was determined to launch a social revolution by enforcing austere Islamic values. They ransacked video stores, music recitals, cinemas, and liquor stores. They demanded that women dress in hijab and rampaged against Egypt's Coptic minority, bombing its churches. They attacked a regional headquarters of the State Security Service, cutting off the head of the commander and killing a large number of policemen. Blood on the ground soon became the measure of the Islamic group's success, and it was all the more exhilarating because the murder was done in the name of God. In 1990, the spokesman for the Islamic group was shot dead in the street in Cairo. There was little doubt that the government was behind the killing, and soon afterward, the Islamic group announced its intention to respond with a terror campaign. Dozens of police officers were murdered. Intellectuals were also on its hit list, including Naguib Mahfouz, the Nobel Prize-winning novelist, who was stabbed in the neck. He survived. Next, the Islamic group targeted the tourist industry, declaring that it corrupted Egyptian society by bringing alien customs and morals which offend Islam. Members of the group attacked tourists with homemade bombs on buses and trains and fired on cruise ships that plied the Nile. The economy swooned. During the 90s, more than 1,200 people were killed in terror attacks in Egypt. The Minister of the Interior, Abdul Halim Musa, responded to this insult by declaring, I don't want prisoners, I want bodies. The exiled members of Al-Jihad jealously decided that they needed to enter the fray. Fadl disagreed. Despite his advocacy of endless warfare against unjust rulers, he contended that the Egyptian government was too powerful and that the insurgency would fail. He also complained that Al-Jihad was undertaking operations only to emulate the Islamic group. This is senseless activity that will bring no benefit, he warned. His point was quickly proved when the Egyptian security services captured a computer containing the names of Zawahiri's followers, nearly 1,000 of whom were arrested. In retaliation, Zawahiri authorized a suicide bombing that targeted Hassan al-Alfi, the interior minister, in August 1993. Alfi survived the attack with a broken arm. 2 months later, al-Jihad attempted to kill Egypt's prime minister, Atef Sidki, in a bombing. The prime minister was not hurt, but the explosion killed a 12-year-old schoolgirl. Embarrassed by these failures, members of Al-Jihad demanded that their leader resign. Many were surprised to discover that the emir was Fadl. He willingly gave up the post, and Zawahiri soon became the leader of al-Jihad in name as well as in fact. In 1994, Fadl moved to Yemen, where he resumed his medical practice and tried to put the work of jihad behind him. Before he left, however, he gave a copy of his finished manuscript to Zawahiri, saying that it could be used to raise money. Few books in recent history have done as much damage. Fadl wrote the book under yet another pseudonym, Abdul Qadir bin Abdulaziz, in part because the name was not Egyptian and would further mask his identity. Given Fadl's critique of al-Jihad's violent operations as senseless, the intransigent and bloodthirsty document that Fadl gave to Zawahiri must have come as a thrilling surprise. The Compendium of the Pursuit of Divine Knowledge, which is more than 1,000 pages long, starts with the assertion that salvation is available only to the perfect Muslim. Even an exemplary believer can wander off the path to paradise with a single misstep. Fadl contends that the rulers of Egypt and other Arab countries are apostates of Islam. The infidel's rule, his prayers, and the prayers of those who pray behind him are invalid. Fadl decrees, his blood is legal. He declares that Muslims have a duty to wage jihad against such leaders. Those who submit to an infidel ruler are themselves infidels and doomed to damnation. The same punishment awaits those who participate in democratic elections. I say to Muslims in all candor that secular nationalist democracy opposes your religion and your doctrine, and in submitting to it you leave God's book behind, he writes. Those who labor in government, the police and the courts, are infidels, as is anyone who works for peaceful change. Religious war, not political reform, is the sole mandate. Even devout believers walk a tightrope over the abyss. A man may enter the faith in many ways, yet be expelled from it by just one deed, Fadl cautions. Anyone who believes otherwise is a heretic and deserves to be slaughtered. Fadl also expands upon the heresy of takfir, the excommunication of one Muslim by another. To deny the faith of a believer without persuasive evidence is a grievous injustice. The Prophet Muhammad is said to have remarked, "When a man calls his brother an infidel, we can be sure that one of them is indeed an infidel." Fadl defines Islam so narrowly, however, that nearly everyone falls outside the sacred boundaries. The compendium gave Al-Qaeda and its allies a warrant to murder all who stood in their way. Zawahiri was ecstatic. Zawahiri exclaimed, "This book is a victory from Almighty God." When Fadl moved to Yemen, he considered his work in revolutionary Islam to be complete. Fadl cut off all contact with bin Laden, complaining that the terrorist leader doesn't listen to the advice of others. He listens only to himself. Fadl moved his two wives, four sons, and two daughters to the mountain town of Ib. He called himself Dr. Abdulaziz al-Sharif. On holidays, the family took walks around the town. Otherwise, he spent his spare time reading. "He didn't care to watch television except for the news," Ismail al-Sharif told me. "He didn't like to make friends because he was a fugitive. He thinks having too many relations is a waste of time." While awaiting a work permit from Yemen's government, Fadl volunteered his services at a local hospital. His skills quickly became evident. "People were coming from all over the country," his son told me. "The fact that Fadl was working without pay in such a primitive facility rather than opening a practice in a gleaming modern clinic in Kuwait or Europe, drew unwelcome attention. He had the profile of a man with something to hide. While in Ibb, Fadl learned that his book had been bowdlerized. His original manuscript contained a barbed critique of the jihadi movement, naming specific organizations and individuals whose actions he disdained. Those sections of the book had been removed. Other parts were significantly altered. Even the title had been changed to Guide to the Path of Righteousness for Jihad and Belief. The thought that a less qualified writer had taken liberties with his masterpiece sent him into a fury. Who might that be? A member of al-Jihad who had come to Yemen for a job broke the news. He informed me that Zawahiri alone was the one who committed these perversions, Fadl said. In 1995, a sheepish Zawahiri traveled to Yemen to appeal to Fadl for forgiveness. By this time, Zawahiri had suspended his operations in Egypt, and his organization was floundering. Now his former emir refused to see him. I do not know anyone in the history of Islam prior to Ayman al-Zawahiri who engaged in such lying, cheating, forgery, and betrayal of trust by transgressing against someone else's book, the inflamed author told Al-Hayat. Zawahiri and Fadl have not spoken since, but their war of words was only beginning. Meanwhile, a furtive conversation was taking place among the imprisoned leaders of the Islamic group, including one of its founders, Karam Zudi. We started growing older, Zudi says. We started examining the evidence. We began to read books and reconsider. Just opening the subject for discussion was extremely threatening, not only for members of the organization, but for groups that had an interest in prolonging the clash with Egypt's government. Zudi points in particular to the Muslim Brotherhood. Instead of supporting us, they wanted us to continue the violence, he says. We faced very strong opposition inside prison, and outside Egypt. In 1997, rumors of a possible deal between the Islamic group and the Egyptian government reached Zawahiri, who was then hiding in an Al-Qaeda safe house in Kandahar, Afghanistan. Muntasir al-Zayat, the Islamist lawyer, was brokering talks between the parties. Zayat has often served as an emissary between the Islamists and the security apparatus, a role that makes him both universally distrusted and invaluable. In his biography of Zawahiri, The Road to Al-Qaeda, the story of bin Laden's right-hand man, Zayat reports that Zawahiri called him in March of that year when Zayat arrived in London on business. Zawahiri was furious about the non-violence initiative. Why are you making the brothers angry? He demanded. Zayat responded that jihad did not have to be restricted to an armed approach. Zawahiri urged Zayat to change his mind, even promising that he could secure political asylum for him in London. I politely rejected his offer, Zayat writes. The talks between the Islamic group and the government remained secret until July, when one of the imprisoned leaders, who was on trial in a military court, stood up and announced to stunned observers the organization's intention to cease all violent activity. Incensed, Zawahiri wrote a letter addressed to the group's imprisoned leaders. God only knows the grief I felt when I heard about this initiative and the negative impact it has caused, he wrote. If we are going to stop now, why did we start in the first place? To Zawahiri's annoyance, imprisoned members of al-Jihad, his own organization, also began to express an interest in joining the Nonviolence Initiative. The leadership started to change its views, said Abdel Moneim Moneib, who in 1993 was charged with being a member of Al-Jihad, although Moneib was never convicted. He spent 14 years in an Egyptian prison. At one point you might mention this idea, and all the voices would drown you out. Later it became possible. Independent thinking on the subject of violence was not easy when as many as 30 men were crammed into cells that were about 9 feet by 15. Except for a few smuggled radios, the prisoners were largely deprived of sources of outside information. They occupied themselves with endless theological debates and glum speculation about where they had gone wrong. Eventually, though, these discussions prompted the imprisoned leaders of Al-Jihad to open their own secret channel with the government. Zawahiri became increasingly isolated within his own movement. He believed that violence was the only fuel that kept the radical Islamist organizations running. They had no future without terror. Together with several leaders of the Islamic group who were living outside Egypt, he plotted a way to raise the stakes and permanently wreck the attempts at reform. On November 17, 1997, just 4 months after the announcement of the Nonviolence Initiative, 6 young men entered the magnificent ruins of Queen Hatshepsut's temple near Luxor. Hundreds of tourists were strolling through the grounds. For 45 minutes, the killers shot randomly. A flyer was stuffed inside a mutilated body, taking credit on behalf of the Islamic group. 62 people died. It was the worst terrorist incident in Egypt's bloody political history. If Zawahiri and the exiled members of the Islamic group hoped that this action would undermine the Nonviolence Initiative, they miscalculated. The Islamic group's imprisoned leaders wrote a series of books and pamphlets, collectively known as the Revisions, in which they formally explained their new thinking. "We wanted to relay our experience to young people, to protect them from falling into the same mistakes we did," Zudi told me. In 1999, the Islamic group called for an end to all armed action, not only in Egypt, but also against America. "The Islamic group does not believe in the creed of killing by nationality," one of its representatives later explained. Before 9/11, the Egyptian government had quietly permitted the Islamic group's leaders to carry their discussions about renouncing violence to members in other prisons around the country. After the attacks, state security decided to call more attention to these debates. Makram Mohammed Ahmed, who was close to the Minister of the Interior and was then the editor of Al-Musawar, a government weekly, was permitted to cover some of the discussions. "There were 3 generations in prison," he said. "They were in despair." Many of these Islamists had fantasized that they would be hailed as heroes by their society. Instead, they were isolated and rejected. Now, Karam Zudi and other imprisoned leaders were asking the radicals to accept that they had been deluded from the beginning. "We began by going from prison to prison," Ahmed recalled. "Those boys would see their leaders giving them the new conception of the Revisions." Ahmed recalls that many of the prisoners were angry. "They would say, 'You've been deceiving us for 18 years. Why didn't you say this before?'" Despite such objections, the 20,000 imprisoned members of the Islamic group largely accepted the leader's new position. Ahmed says that he was initially skeptical of the prisoners' apparent repentance, which looked like a ploy for better treatment. However, several of the participants in the discussions had already been sentenced to death and were wearing the red clothing that identifies a prisoner as a condemned man. They had nothing to gain. Ahmed says that one of these prisoners told him, "I'm not offering these revisions for Mubarak. I don't care about this government. What is important is that I killed people, Copts, innocent persons, and before I meet God, I should declare my sins." Then the man burst into tears. The moral dimensions of the prisoner's predicament unfolded as they explored the ramifications of the revisions. What about the brother who was killed while carrying out an attack that we now realize was against Islam? Is he a martyr? If not, how do we console his family? One of the leaders proposed that if the brother who died was sincere, although genuinely deceived, he would still gain his heavenly reward. However, because everyone knows there is no advantage to violence, and that it is religiously incorrect, from now on, those who commit such actions were doomed. What about correcting the sins of other Muslims? The Islamic group had a reputation in Egypt for acting as a kind of moral police force, often quite savagely. For instance, throwing acid in the faces of women wearing makeup. "We used to blame the people and say, 'The people are cowards,'" one of the leaders admitted. "None of us thought of saying that the violence we employed was abhorrent to them." These emotional discussions were widely covered in the Egyptian press. Zudi publicly apologized to the Egyptian people for the Islamic group's violent deeds, beginning with the murder of Sadat, whom he called a martyr. The Egyptian government responded to the nonviolence initiative by releasing 12,500 members of the Islamic group. Many of them had never been charged with a crime, much less tried and sentenced. Some were shattered by their confinement. "Imagine what 20 years of prison can do," Zudi said. The prisoners returned to a society that was far more religious than the one they had left. They must have been heartened to see most Egyptian women, who once enjoyed Western fashions, now wearing the hijab, or completely hidden behind facial veils. Many more Egyptian men had prayer marks on their foreheads. Imams had become celebrities, their sermons blaring from televisions and radios. These newly released men might fairly have believed that they had achieved a great social victory through their actions and their sacrifice. And yet the brutal indifference of the Egyptian government toward its people was unchanged. As the Islamists emerged from prison, new detainees took their place. Protesters, liberals, bloggers, candidates for political office. Wealth was increasingly concentrated in the hands of the already rich. Meanwhile, the price of food was shooting up so quickly that people were going hungry. Within a few months of being released, hundreds of the Islamists petitioned, unsuccessfully, to be let back into prison. From the Egyptian government's point of view, the deal with the Islamic group has proved to be an unparalleled success. According to Makram Mohammed Ahmed, the former editor of Al-Musawar, who witnessed the prison debates, there have been only two instances where members showed signs of returning to their former violent ways, and in both cases they were betrayed by informers in their own group. Prison or time may have defeated them, Montasser Al-Zayat, the lawyer, says of the Islamic group. Some would call it a collapse. Dr. Fuddle was practicing surgery in Ibb when the 9/11 attacks took place. "We heard the reports first on BBC radio," his son Ismail Al-Sharif recalls. After his shift ended, Fuddle returned home and watched the television coverage with his family. They asked him who he thought was responsible. "This action is from Al-Qaeda, because there is no other group in the world that will kill themselves in a plane," he responded. On October 28, 2001, two Yemeni intelligence officers came to Fadl's clinic to ask him some questions. He put them off. The director of the hospital persuaded Fadl to turn himself in, saying that he would pull some strings to protect him. Fadl was held in Ib for a week before being transferred to government detention in the capital, Sana'a. The Speaker of the Parliament and other prominent Yemeni politicians agitated unsuccessfully for his release. In Fadl's opinion, Al-Qaeda had committed group suicide by striking America, which was bound to retaliate severely. Indeed, nearly 80% of Al-Qaeda's members in Afghanistan were killed in the final months of 2001. My father was very sad for the killing of Abu Hafs al-Masri, the military leader of Al-Qaeda, Ismail al-Sharif told Al Jarida. My father said that with the death of Abu Hafs, Al-Qaeda is finished, because the rest is a group of zeros. At first, Yemeni authorities weren't sure what to do with the celebrated jihadi philosopher. There were many Yemenis, even in the intelligence agencies, who sympathized with Al-Qaeda. Fadl was offered the opportunity to escape to any country he wanted. Fadl said that he would go to Sudan, but the promised release was postponed. The following year, the offer was changed. Either Fadl could seek political asylum, or Egyptian authorities would come and get him. Fadl applied for asylum, but before he received a response, he disappeared. According to a 2005 report by Human Rights Watch, which was following his case, Fadl was taken from his cell and smuggled onto a plane to Cairo. For more than 2 years, Fadl, who had been tried and convicted in absentia on terrorism charges, was secretly held by Egyptian authorities. He was eventually transferred to the Scorpion, a facility inside Tora Prison where major political figures are held. It was clear that he was getting special treatment. His son says that he has a private room with a bath and a small kitchen, adding, he has a refrigerator and a television, and the newspaper comes every day. Fadl passes the time reading and trying not to gain weight. The Egyptian authorities rejected multiple requests to speak with Fadl in prison. There may be many inducements for Dr. Fadl's revisions, torture among them, but his smoldering resentment of Zawahiri's literary crimes was obviously a factor. Fadl claimed in Al-Hayat that his differences with Zawahiri were objective, not personal. He was a burden to me on the educational, professional, jurisprudential, and sometimes personal levels, Fadl complained. He was ungrateful for the kindness I had shown him and bit the hand that I had extended to him. What I got for my efforts was deception, betrayal, lies, and thuggery. The first segment of Dr. Fadl's new book appeared in the newspapers Al-Masri Al-Yum and Al Jarida in November 2007 on the 10th anniversary of the Luxor massacre. Titled Rationalizing Jihad in Egypt and the World, it attempted to reconcile Fadl's well-known bloodthirsty views with his sweeping modifications. A majority of the Al-Jihad members in prison signed Fadl's manuscript, hoping, no doubt, to follow their Islamic group colleagues out the prison door. Hisham Qasim, a human rights activist and publisher in Cairo, told me that the newspapers that published Fadl's work bought it from the Ministry of the Interior for 150,000 Egyptian pounds. The circumstances of the publication added to the general suspicion that the government had supervised the revisions, if not actually written them. Perhaps to counter that impression, Mohammed Salah, the Cairo bureau chief of Al-Hayat, was allowed into Tora prison to interview Fadl. In the resulting six-part series, Fadl defended the work as his own and left no doubt of his personal grudge against Zawahiri. Whatever the motivations behind the writing of the book, its publication amounted to a major assault on radical Islamist theology from the man who had originally formulated much of that thinking. The premise that opens rationalizing jihad is, "There is nothing that invokes the anger of God and his wrath like the unwarranted spilling of blood and wrecking of property." Fadl then establishes a new set of rules for jihad, which essentially define most forms of terrorism as illegal under Islamic law and restrict the possibility of holy war to extremely rare circumstances. His argument may seem arcane, even to most Muslims, but to men who had risked their lives in order to carry out what they saw as the authentic precepts of their religion, every word assaulted their worldview and brought into question their chances for salvation. In order to declare jihad, Fadl writes, one must observe certain requirements. One must have a place of refuge. There should be adequate financial resources to wage the campaign. Fadl castigates Muslims who resort to theft or kidnapping to finance jihad. There is no such thing in Islam as ends justifying the means. Family members must be provided for. There are those who strike and then escape, leaving their families, dependents, and other Muslims to suffer the consequences, Fadl points out. This is in no way religion or jihad. It is not manliness. Finally, the enemy should be properly identified in order to prevent harm to innocents. Those who have not followed these principles have committed the gravest of sins, Fadl writes. To wage jihad, one must first gain permission from one's parents and creditors. The potential warrior also needs the blessing of a qualified imam or sheikh. He can't simply respond to the summons of a charismatic leader acting in the name of Islam. O you young people, do not be deceived by the heroes of the internet, the leaders of the microphones, who are launching statements inciting the youth while living under the protection of intelligence services or of a tribe, or in a distant cave, or under political asylum in an infidel country, Fadl warns. They have thrown many others before you into the infernos, graves, and prisons. Even if a person is fit and capable, jihad may not be required of him, Fadl says, pointing out that God also praises those who choose to isolate themselves from unbelievers rather than fight them. Nor is jihad required if the enemy is twice as powerful as the Muslims. In such an unequal contest, Fadl writes, God permitted peace treaties and ceasefires with the infidels, either in exchange for money or without it, all of this in order to protect the Muslims, in contrast with those who push them into peril. In what sounds like a deliberate swipe at Zawahiri, he remarks, those who have triggered clashes and pressed their brothers into unequal military confrontations are specialists neither in fatwas nor in military affairs. Just as those who practice medicine without background should provide compensation for the damage they have done, the same goes for those who issue fatwas without being qualified to do so. Despite his previous call for jihad against unjust Muslim rulers, Fadl now says that such rulers can be fought only if they are unbelievers, and even then, only to the extent that the battle will improve the situation of Muslims. Obviously, that has not been the case in Egypt or most other Islamic countries, where increased repression has been the usual result of armed insurgency. Fadl quotes the Prophet Muhammad, advising Muslims to be patient with their flawed leaders. Those who rebel against the Sultan shall die a pagan death. Fadl repeatedly emphasizes that it is forbidden to kill civilians, including Christians and Jews, unless they are actively attacking Muslims. There is nothing in the Sharia about killing Jews and the Nazarenes, referred to by some as the Crusaders, Fadl observes. They are the neighbors of the Muslims, and being kind to one's neighbors is a religious duty. Indiscriminate bombing, such as blowing up of hotels, buildings, and public transportation, is not permitted, because innocents will surely die. If vice is mixed with virtue, all becomes sinful, he writes. There is no legal reason for harming people in any way. The prohibition against killing applies even to foreigners inside Muslim countries, since many of them may be Muslims. You cannot decide who is a Muslim, or who is an unbeliever, or who should be killed based on the color of his skin or hair, or the language he speaks, or because he wears Western fashion, Fadl writes. These are not proper indications for who is a Muslim and who is not. As for foreigners who are non-Muslims, they may have been invited into the country for work, which is a kind of treaty. What's more, there are many Muslims living in foreign lands considered inimical to Islam, and yet those Muslims are treated fairly. Therefore, Muslims should reciprocate in their own countries. To Muslims living in non-Islamic countries, Fadl sternly writes, I say it is not honorable to reside with people, even if they were non-believers and not part of a treaty, if they gave you permission to enter their homes and live with them, and if they gave you security for yourself and your money, and if they gave you the opportunity to work or study, or they granted you political asylum, with a decent life and other acts of kindness, and then betray them through killing and destruction. This was not in the manners and practices of the Prophet. Fadl does not condemn all jihadist activity, however. Jihad in Afghanistan will lead to the creation of an Islamic state with the triumph of the Taliban, God willing, he declares. The jihads in Iraq and Palestine are more problematic. As Fadl sees it, if it were not for the jihad in Palestine, the Jews would have crept toward the neighboring countries a long time ago. Even so, he writes, the Palestinian cause has for some time been a grape leaf used by the bankrupt leaders to cover their own faults. Fadl addresses the bloody division between Sunnis and Shiites that is at the heart of Islam. Harming those who are affiliated with Islam but have a different creed is forbidden. He quotes Ibn Taymiyyah, one of the revered scholars of early Islam, who is also bin Laden's favorite authority. A Muslim's blood and money are safeguarded, even if his creed is different. Fadl still asserts that terrorizing the enemy is a legitimate duty. However, he points out legitimate terror has many constraints. Al-Qaeda's terrorist attacks in America, London, and Madrid were wrong because they were based on nationality, a form of indiscriminate slaughter forbidden by Islam. In his Al-Hayat interview, Fadl labels 9/11 a catastrophe for Muslims because Al-Qaeda's actions caused the death of tens of thousands of Muslims, Arabs, Afghans, Pakistanis, and others. Fadl's most original argument is his assertion that the hijackers of 9/11 betrayed the enemy because they had been given U.S. visas, which are a contract of protection. The followers of bin Laden entered the United States with his knowledge and on his orders double-crossed its population, killing and destroying, Fadl continues. The Prophet, God's prayer and peace be upon him, said, On the day of judgment, Every double-crosser will have a banner up his anus proportionate to his treachery. At one point, Fadl observes, people hate America, and the Islamist movements feel their hatred and their impotence. Ramming America has become the shortest road to fame and leadership among the Arabs and Muslims. But what good is it if you destroy one of your enemy's buildings, and he destroys one of your countries? What good is it if you kill one of his people, and he kills 1,000 of yours? That, in short, is my evaluation of 9/11. If the security services in Egypt, in tandem with the Al-Azhar scholars, had undertaken to write a refutation of Al-Qaeda's doctrine, it would likely have resembled the book that Dr. Fadl produced. And indeed, that may have been exactly what occurred. And yet, with so many leaders of Al-Jihad endorsing the work, it seemed clear that the organization in Egypt itself was now dead. Terrorism might continue in some form, but the historic violent factions were finished, departing amid public exclamations of repentance for the futility and sinfulness of their actions. As the Muslim world awaited Zawahiri's inevitable response, the press and the clergy were surprisingly muted. One reason was that Fadl's revisions raised doubts about political activity that many Muslims do not regard as terror. For instance, the resistance movements in Palestine and elsewhere that oppose Israel and the presence of American troops in Muslim countries. In this region, we must distinguish between violence against national governments and that of the resistance in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Palestine. Essam el-Aryan, the spokesman of the Muslim Brotherhood, told me, we cannot call this resistance violence. Nevertheless, such movements were inevitably drawn into the debate surrounding Fadl's book. A number of Muslim clerics struggled to answer Dr. Fadl's broad critique of political bloodshed. Many had issued fatwas endorsing the very actions that Fadl now declared to be unjustified. Their responses were often surprising. For instance, Sheikh Hamid al-Ali, an influential Salafi cleric in Kuwait, whom the U.S. Treasury has described as an Al-Qaeda facilitator and fundraiser, declared on a website that he welcomed the rejection of violence as a means of fostering change in the Arab world. Sheikh Ali's fatwas have sometimes been linked to Al-Qaeda actions. Notoriously, months before 9/11, he authorized flying aircraft into targets during suicide operations. He observed that although the Arab regimes have a natural self-interest in encouraging nonviolence, that shouldn't cause readers to spurn Fadl's argument. I believe it is a big mistake to let this important intellectual transformation be nullified by political suspicion, Ali said. The decision of radical Islamist groups to adopt a peaceful path does not necessarily mean, however, that they can evolve into political parties. We have to admit that we do not have in our land a true political process worthy of the name, Ali argued. What we have are regimes that play a game in which they use whatever will guarantee their continued existence. On the other hand, Sheikh Abu Basir al-Tartusi, a Syrian Islamist living in London, railed against the numbness and discouragement of Fadl's message in telling Muslims that they are too weak to engage in jihad or overthrow their oppressive rulers. More than half of the Quran and hundreds of the Prophet's sayings call for jihad and fighting those unjust tyrants, Tartusi exclaimed on a jihadist website. What do you want us to do with this huge quantity of Sharia provisions, and how do you want us to understand and interpret them? Where is the benefit in deserting jihad against those tyrants? Because of them, the nation lost its religion, glory, honor, dignity, land, resources, and every precious thing. Jihadist publications were filled with condemnations of Fadl's revisions. Hani El-Sibai, the Islamist attorney, is a Zawahiri loyalist who runs a political website in London. He said of Fadl, "Do you think any Islamic group will listen to him? No. They are in the middle of a war." Even so, the fact that Al-Qaeda followers and sympathizers were paying so much attention to Fadl's manuscript made it imperative that Zawahiri offer a definitive refutation, since Al-Qaeda's violent ideology rested so much on Fadl's foundation. Zawahiri would have to find a way to discredit the author without destroying the authority of his own organization. It was a tricky task. In February 2008, Zawahiri announced in a video that he had finished a letter responding to Fadl's book. "The Islam presented by that document is the one that America and the West wants and is pleased with. An Islam without jihad," Zawahiri said, "because I consider this document to be an insult to the Muslim nation, I chose for the rebuttal the name The Exoneration, in order to express the nation's innocence of this insult." This public response to internal dissent was unprecedented. The letter, which finally appeared on the internet the following month, was nearly 200 pages long. "This message I present to the reader today is among the most difficult I have ever written in my life," Zawahiri admits in his introduction. Although the text is laden with footnotes and lengthy citations from Islamic scholars, Zawahiri's strategy is apparent from the beginning. Whereas Fadl's book is a trenchant attack on the immoral roots of Al-Qaeda's theology, Zawahiri navigates his argument toward the familiar shores of the Zionist Crusader conspiracy. Zawahiri claims that Fadl wrote his book in the spirit of the Minister of the Interior. He characterizes it as a desperate attempt by the enemies of Islam, America, the West, Jews, the apostate rulers of the Muslim world, to stand in the way of the fierce wave of jihadi revivalism that is shaking the Islamic world. "Mistakes have been made," he concedes. "I neither condone the killing of innocent people nor claim that jihad is free of error," he writes. "Muslim leaders during the time of the Prophet made mistakes, but the jihad did not stop. I'm warning those Islamist groups who welcome the document that they are giving the government the knife with which it can slaughter them." In presenting Al-Qaeda's defense, Zawahiri displays the moral relativism that underlies the organization. "Keep in mind that we have the right to do to the infidels what they have done to us," he writes. "We bomb them as they bomb us, even if we kill someone who is not permitted to be killed." He compares 9/11 to the 1998 American bombing of a pharmaceutical plant in Sudan, in retaliation for Al-Qaeda's destruction of two American embassies in East Africa. The U.S. mistakenly believed that the plant was producing chemical weapons. "I see no difference between the two operations, except that the money used to build the factory was Muslim money, and the workers who died in the factory's rubble, actually a single night watchman, were Muslims, while the money that was spent on the buildings that those hijackers destroyed was infidel money, and the people who died in the explosion were infidels." When Zawahiri questions the sanctity of a visa, which Fadl equates with a mutual contract of safe passage, he consults an English dictionary and finds in the definition of visa no mention of a guarantee of protection. "Even if the contract is based on international agreements, we are not bound by those agreements," Zawahiri claims, citing two radical clerics who support his view. In any case, America doesn't feel bound to protect Muslims. For instance, he claims it is torturing people in its military prisons in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The U.S. gives itself the right to take any Muslim without respect to his visa. Zawahiri writes, "If the U.S. and Westerners don't respect visas, why should we?" Zawahiri clumsily dodges many of the most penetrating of Fadl's arguments. The writer speaks of violations of the Sharia, such as killing people because of their nationality, skin color, hair color, or denomination. He complains in a characteristic passage. This is another example of making accusations without evidence. No one ever talked about killing people because of their skin color or hair color. I demand the writer produce specific incidents with specific dates. Zawahiri makes some telling psychological points. For instance, he says that the imprisoned Fadl is projecting his own weakness on the Mujahideen, who have grown stronger since Fadl deserted them 15 years earlier. The Islamic Mujahid movement was not defeated by the grace of God. Indeed, because of its patience, steadfastness, and thoughtfulness, it is headed toward victory, he writes. He cites the strikes on 9/11 and the ongoing battles in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Somalia, which he says are wearing America down. To dispute Fadl's assertion that Muslims living in non-Islamic countries are treated fairly, Zawahiri points out that in some Western countries, Muslim girls are forbidden to wear the hijab to school. Muslim men are prevented from marrying more than one wife and from beating their wives, as allowed by some interpretations of Sharia. Muslims are barred from donating money to certain Islamic causes, although money is freely and openly raised for Israel. He cites the 2005 cartoon controversy in Denmark and the celebrity of the author Salman Rushdie as examples of Western countries exalting those who denigrate Islam. He says that some Western laws prohibiting anti-Semitic remarks would forbid Muslims to recite certain passages in the Quran dealing with the treachery of the Jews. Writing about the treatment of tourists, Zawahiri says, "The Mujahideen don't kidnap people randomly. They purposely kidnap or harm tourists to send a message to their home countries. We don't attack Brazilian tourists in Finland or those from Vietnam in Venezuela," he writes. No doubt Muslims may be killed occasionally, but if that happens, it's a pardonable mistake. The majority of scholars say that it is permissible to strike at infidels, even if Muslims are among them, Zawahiri contends. He cites a well-known verse in the Quran to support, among other things, the practice of kidnapping. "When the sacred months are drawn away, slay the idolaters wherever you find them, and take them, and confine them, and lie in wait for them at every place of ambush." As for 9/11, Zawahiri writes, "The Mujahideen didn't attack the West in its home country with suicide attacks in order to break treaties, or out of a desire to spill blood, or because they were half mad, or because they suffer from frustration and failure, as many imagine. They attacked it because they were forced to defend their community and their sacred religion from centuries of aggression. They had no means other than suicide attacks to defend themselves." Zawahiri's argument demonstrates why Islam is so vulnerable to radicalization. It is a religion that was born in conflict, and in its long history, it has developed a reservoir of opinions and precedents that are supposed to govern the behavior of Muslims toward their enemies. Some of Zawahiri's commentary may seem comically academic, as in this citation in support of the need for Muslims to prepare for jihad. Imam Ahmad said, "We heard from Harun bin Maruf, citing Abu Wahab, who quoted Amru bin al-Harith, citing Abu Ali Tamama bin Shafi, that he heard Uqba bin Amir saying, I heard the Prophet say from the pulpit, Against them make ready your strength. Strength refers to shooting arrows and other projectiles from instruments of war. Such proofs of the rightfulness of jihad, or taking captives, or slaughtering the enemy, are easily found in the commentaries of scholars, the rulings of Sharia courts, the volumes of the Prophet's sayings, and the Quran itself. Crude interpretations of Islamic texts can lead men like Zawahiri to conclude that murder should be celebrated. They come to believe that religion is science. They see their actions as logical, righteous, and mandatory. In this fashion, a surgeon is transformed from a healer into a killer, but only if the candle of individual conscience has been extinguished. Several times in his lengthy response, Zawahiri complains of double standards when critics attack Al-Qaeda's tactics, but ignores similar actions on the part of Palestinian organizations. He notes that Fadl ridicules the fighting within Al-Qaeda. Why don't you ask Hamas the same thing? Zawahiri demands. Isn't this a clear contradiction? At another point, Zawahiri concedes the failure of al-Jihad to overthrow the Egyptian government, then adds, Neither has the 80-year-old Jihad kicked the occupier out of Palestine. He goes on to point out that Palestinian missiles also indiscriminately kill children and the elderly, even Arabs. But no one holds the Palestinians to the same ethical standards as Al-Qaeda. Zawahiri has watched Al-Qaeda's popularity decline in places where it formerly enjoyed great support. In Pakistan, where hundreds have been killed by Al-Qaeda suicide bombers, including perhaps former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, public opinion has turned against bin Laden and his companions. An Algerian terror organization, the Salafist Group for Preaching and Combat, formally affiliated itself with Al-Qaeda in September 2006 and began a series of suicide bombings that have alienated the Algerian people. Long weary of the horrors that Islamist radicals have inflicted on their country, even members of Al-Qaeda admit that their cause has been harmed by indiscriminate violence. In February 2008, Abu Turab al-Jaziri, an Al-Qaeda commander in northern Iraq, whose nom de guerre suggests that he is Algerian, gave an interview to Al-Arab, a Qatari daily. The attacks in Algeria sparked animated debate here in Iraq, he said. By God, had they told me they were planning to harm the Algerian president and his family, I would say blessings be upon them. But explosions in the street, blood knee-deep, the killing of soldiers whose wages are not even enough for them to eat at third-rate restaurants, and calling this jihad? By God, it's sheer idiocy. In Saudi Arabia, Sheikh Salman al-Oda, a cleric whom bin Laden had praised in the past, appeared on an Arabic television network in 2007 and read an open letter to the Al-Qaeda leader. He asked, Brother Osama, how much blood has been spilled? How many innocent children, women, and old people have been killed, maimed, and expelled from their homes in the name of Al-Qaeda? These critiques echoed some of the concerns of the influential Palestinian cleric, Sheikh Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi. Mujahideen should refrain from acts that target civilians, churches, or other places of worship, including Shiite sites, Maqdisi wrote in 2004. The hands of the jihad warriors must remain clean. In order to staunch the flow of criticism, Zawahiri boldly initiated a virtual town hall meeting, soliciting questions in an online forum. In the spring of 2008, he released two lengthy audio responses to nearly 100 of the 900 often testy queries that were posed. The first one came from a man who identified himself, sardonically, as the geography teacher. "Excuse me, Mr. Zawahiri, but who is it who is killing, with your excellency's permission, the innocents in Baghdad, Morocco, and Algeria? Do you consider the killing of women and children to be jihad?" Then he demanded, "Why have you not, to this day, carried out any strike in Israel? Or is it easier to kill Muslims in the markets? Maybe you should study geography, because your maps show only the Muslim states." Zawahiri protested that Al-Qaeda had not killed innocents. "In fact, we fight those who kill innocents. Those who kill innocents are the Americans, the Jews, the Russians, and the French and their agents." As for Al-Qaeda's failure to attack Israel, despite bin Laden's constant exploitation of the issue, Zawahiri asks, "Why does the questioner focus on how Al-Qaeda in particular must strike Israel, while he didn't request that jihadist organizations in Palestine come to the aid of their brothers in Chechnya, Afghanistan, and Iraq?" The murder of innocents emerged as the most prominent issue in the exchanges. An Algerian university student sarcastically congratulated Zawahiri for killing 60 Muslims in Algeria on a holy feast day. What was their sin, the student wanted to know. "Those who were killed on the 11th of December in Algeria are not from the innocents," Zawahiri claimed. "They are from the Crusader unbelievers and the government troops who defend them. Our brothers in Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, North Africa, are more truthful, more just, and more righteous than the lying sons of France." The Saudi wondered how Muslims could justify supporting Al-Qaeda, given its long history of indiscriminate murder. "Are there other ways and means in which the objectives of jihad can be achieved without killing people?" he asked. "Please do not use as a pretext what the Americans or others are doing. Muslims are supposed to be an example to the world in tolerance and lofty goals, not to become a gang whose only concern is revenge." But Zawahiri was unable to rise to the questioner's ethical challenge. He replied, "If a criminal were to storm into your house, attack your family, and kill them, steal your property, and burn down your house, then turns to attack the homes of your neighbors, will you treat him tolerantly so that you will not become a gang whose only concern is revenge?" Zawahiri even had to defend himself for helping to spread the myth that the Israelis carried out the attacks of 9/11. He placed the blame for this rumor on Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shiite organization, which aired the notion on its television station, Al-Manar. Zawahiri said indignantly, "The objective behind this lie is to deny that the Sunnis have heroes who harm America as no one has harmed it throughout its history." Many of the questions dealt with Dr. Fadl, beginning with why Zawahiri had altered, without permission, Fadl's Encyclopedia of Jihadist Philosophy, the Compendium of the Pursuit of Divine Knowledge. Zawahiri claimed that the writing of the book was a joint effort because Al-Jihad had financed it. He had to edit the book because it was full of theological errors. "We neither forged anything nor meddled with anything," Zawahiri said. Later, he added, "I ask those who are firm in their covenant not to pay attention to this propaganda war that the United States is launching in its prisons, which are situated in our countries." Fadl's revisions, Zawahiri warned, place restrictions on jihadist action, which, if implemented, would destroy jihad completely. One afternoon in Cairo, I visited Kamal Habib, a key leader of the first generation of al-Jihad, who is now a political scientist and analyst. His writing has gained him an audience of former radicals, who, like him, have sought a path back to moderation. We met in the cafeteria of the Journalists' Syndicate in downtown Cairo. Habib is an energetic political theorist, unbroken by 10 years in prison, despite having been tortured. His arms are marked with scars from cigarette burns. "We now have before us two schools of thought," Habib told me. "The old school, which was expressed by al-Jihad and its spin-off al-Qaeda, is the one that was led by Ayman al-Zawahiri, Sheikh Makdisi, Zarqawi. The new school, which Dr. Fadl has given expression to, represents a battle of faith. It's deeper than just ideology," he went on. "The general mood of Islamist movements in the 70s was intransigence. Now the general mood is toward harmony and coexistence. The distance between the two is a measure of their experience." Ironically, Dr. Fadl's thinking gave birth to both schools. As long as a person lives in a world of jihad, the old vision will control his thinking, Habib suggested. When he's in battle, he doesn't wonder if he's wrong or he's right. When he's arrested, he has time to wonder. Dr. Fadl's revisions and Zawahiri's response show that the movement is disintegrating. Karam Zudi, the Islamic group leader, told me one afternoon in his modest apartment in Alexandria. He is a striking figure, 56 years old, with blonde hair and black eyebrows. His daughter, who is 4, wrapped herself around his leg as an old black-and-white Egyptian movie played silently on a television. Such movies provide a glimpse of a more tolerant and hopeful time, before Egypt took its dark turn into revolution and Islamist violence. I asked Zudi how his country might have been different if he and his colleagues had never chosen the bloody path. "It would have been a lot better now," he admitted. "Our opting for violence encouraged al-Jihad to emerge." He even suggested that had the Islamists not murdered Sadat in 1981, there would be peace today between the Palestinians and the Israelis. He quoted the Prophet Muhammad, "Only what benefits people stays on the earth." "It's very easy to start violence," Zudi said. "Peace is much more difficult."